There's a powerful new voting bloc in America. They're white, working class, and they live in places that have been left behind.
Jackson, Kentucky is an Eastern Kentucky coal town, so about 6,000 people live there. Most people are pretty poor. The schools aren't doing especially well. There are huge problems with addiction and prescription opioid abuse. It's pretty tough.
This is J.D. Vance describing his hometown, where generations of his family grew up. It's the kind of place a lot of people would look down on. But what J.D. sees is a place where no matter how poor and hardscrabble the life, people treat each other with kindness and respect.
It was in Jackson where I first noticed that whenever the funeral motorcade passed by, everyone would get out of their cars and stop and stand at attention. And that's the only place I've ever really seen that. I've never seen it outside of Eastern Kentucky. And there was just this sense that people were a little bit slower in the ways of living and consequently were much more respectful of each other and, even after they died.
I'm Anne Strainchamps, and today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the kind of people who live in places like Jackson, Kentucky, get characterized as poor, white, and angry. Worse, as redneck and racist, hillbilly white trash. J.D. Vance knows them well. They're his people. He grew up in Kentucky coal country and the Ohio Rust Belt, places he left behind when he went to Yale Law School. Today he practices in Silicon Valley, but he's just written a book called Hillbilly Elegy, which frankly should be required reading for this election year. Welcome to Jackson, Kentucky.
It's this sort of place where people are really, really proud of their families, but don't necessarily have the traditional markers of success to be proud of. So they're proud of little things that their family did. You remember that time 50 years ago, even if you weren't alive then, where your uncle or aunt did something really funny or stood up for the family's honor. Because you really did, maybe it's just that you were poor and so you didn't have a whole lot else to hang on to, but you really valued that sense that you were part of a family and that it was your job to protect your family's honor and pride of place in the world.
There are legendary stories in your family that you grew up hearing about the things your uncles or grandparents did to protect the family's honor. Can you tell one or two? Because they're such great stories.
Sure. So, a couple that come to mind. So there were famously my Uncle Pet, who was very calm, but had an especially mean temper. So he had moved to Indiana when he was a teenager and had started some sort of lumber business. And somebody was dropping off a delivery of timber, I believe. And the person said, "Offload this truck now, you son of a bee." And my Uncle Pet said, when you call me a son of a bee, you're insulting my dear old mother back in Eastern Kentucky, and I'd kindly ask you to retract. And the man's name, who was Big Red, because he was a big guy with red hair, said, "Well, offload this truck now, you SOB." So repeated the insult, and Pet pulled him from the truck, beat him unconscious, and then actually ran an electric saw up and down his body. I mean, the man almost bled to death.
God.
And it's the sort of thing where it's unbelievable, except that I've heard it from so many different people, even people who don't know each other, that there has to be an element of truth to it. And, allegedly, Uncle Pet never spent a day in jail because the man who he had injured was also an Appalachian man, also had Eastern Kentucky roots, and really understood what it meant to insult a man's mother, so wouldn't talk to the police when they came around and asked him what had happened.
Mm. So it's a code.
Oh, it's absolutely a code, and it's a code that I think extends through the generations. My grandma was 9 or 10 when her older brother overheard somebody say that he wanted to eat her panties, which, of course, was not an especially nice thing to say. And her older brother, my Uncle T-Berry is what we called him because that was his favorite flavor of chewing gum, he actually went back home, retrieved a pair of my grandma's underwear, and made this 9-year-old kid eat them at knife point.
And that
was what he said, "Look, you want to eat her underwear? Here you go. Go ahead." And he made him, consume those undergarments. And that just, again, goes to show how important it was for us to, one, take on this honor code, to really internalize it, but then to defend it ourselves if we had to.
You were talking about the feeling of loyalty and that you've got to keep the stories inside the family. in some ways, one of the worst things that happened to you, and a lot of bad things happened. You know, you lived off and on with your mother, but she was pretty unstable. Tell me about the day, a really bad day, maybe the worst day. You were pretty young, and you were driving in the car with your mom, and she got really, really mad. And you should tell the story.
Yeah. So I don't remember what had preceded this. I know that something bad had happened because I was staying at my grandparents, and mom came over to apologize and offered to go and take me out for a day of fun. And so I eventually relented, and things were going, you know, okay. And then eventually something triggered mom's temper, and she began driving very, very fast. She began yelling at me for whatever had happened the previous day. And she started to say, look, JD, I'm going to crash this car and kill us both. I'm just going to crash this car and kill us both. And obviously very, very terrifying. I was maybe 11, 12 years old. And I just remember in that moment of terror, I unbuckled my seatbelt and hopped in the back seat of the car because I thought maybe I would be safer back there. I don't know exactly what I was thinking, but this really angered her. So she pulled over the car and prepared to punish me in some way. And I just lost it. So I got out of the car. We were in a pretty rural part of Ohio. And I remember running through a rural field just trying to escape her. And I don't know how far I ran, but I eventually found this woman who was actually relaxing in her above-ground pool in this little country home that she had. And I just told her, my mom is trying to kill me. My mom's trying to hurt me. Call the police. Please call the police. So she did eventually, and about the time that mom found out where I was, the police arrived on scene, and so they arrested her and took her away, and that started this sort of domestic violence case that caused, you know, the child welfare bureaucracy to intrude on our lives for the very first time. Obviously, the sort of thing that was pretty traumatic as a child and caused, I think, a lot of negative things for our family down the line. You know, it doesn't just stop there. Those sorts of events leave their mark in various ways.
And yet, you sat in family court, and when they asked you if your mom had done any of that, you said no.
Yeah, that's true. And I you know, there were a couple of reasons. One, I remember the lawyer told me before the proceedings started, you know, JD, do you want your mom to go to jail? And the answer is that I certainly didn't. And I really wanted this whole process to stop. I wanted these child welfare workers out of our home. I wanted to stop doing these interviews that I had to do. But there was also this interesting cultural identity that arose from this moment. I remember sitting in the domestic violence courtroom before everything got started, and I looked around and I noticed that there were fundamentally two groups of people. There were all the people who were subjected to the court system, so people like my family. You know, they had t-shirts on, they had jeans on, they had maybe stringy hair, they were a little unkempt, they were clearly uncomfortable to be in this place. And importantly, they talked like us, right? They had that sort of Eastern Kentucky drawl. And it occurred to me that all of the people subjected to the court proceedings were like us, and all of the people who ran the court proceedings, from the judges to the lawyers, were not like us. They were like outsiders. They had what I called TV accents, clean and neutral and perfect. And I just didn't want to be part of that system anymore. I felt like for the first time that my people were being subjected to something, and I wanted that subjugation to just stop. I wanted to go and do my own thing. And of course, the irony is that that entire apparatus existed to help me, but it speaks to how strong this sense of cultural alienation is, because I just wanted those people to get out of our lives.
So when you left, you went off to, you know, college and the Marines, and then you wound up at Yale Law School. That must have been complicated for you, because you must have felt like you didn't really fit among the elites. But did you also sometimes feel like a traitor to your class?
Oh, yeah. I felt like both of those things in pretty large volumes, probably. On the one hand, I definitely felt, and didn't quite appreciate this until I got to Yale, that being a member of the elite was less about money, which is what I assumed, and it's more about cultural belonging. It's more about knowing how to conduct yourself at a networking dinner, how to navigate through these informal career and educational networks. So there was a sense in which I just didn't know how the elites actually lived their lives, and I had to learn a lot. But on the other hand, I did feel a bit like a class traitor, because home was continuing on apace, right? I mean, it was while I was in the Yale Law School that I first heard about my mom doing heroin, which, you know, she had struggled with addiction for a long time, but heroin has a very certain ring. And I knew that back home, my aunt and my sister were dealing with all of this while I was going to lectures with Tony Blair and talking with my classmates about how their six-figure salary wouldn't be enough to afford a nice preschool in Manhattan, right? I mean, there was just this unbelievable disconnect between the life that I felt like I was slowly moving into and the life of people back home. And it created, you know, almost something like survivor's guilt. I just felt like something I was doing was fundamentally unfair to the community that I came from. And I don't know that that feeling will ever totally go away.
Mm-hmm. Because this is something I've puzzled about reading your book. Because to the people that you grew up with, I would seem like I am one of the elites. My father's a university professor. I went to an East Coast liberal arts college. I work in public radio.
Right.
And yet, one of my grandmothers grew up as a real hillbilly in southern Missouri. I mean, barefoot, flour sack dress. She spoke a dialect so thick she had to teach herself standard English after she left home, which she did as a teenager. That's just a couple of generations difference. So why is there such a gulf between the people you came from and me?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know that I have a great answer, but my sense is that it's not just something that's transpired over the generations. It's something that's happened just in the geographic isolation that's happened in a lot of these communities. It's just a matter of fact that there are certain cities and certain regions that have collected a large share of the upwardly mobile, well-educated population of the country. And so those areas just feel sometimes like foreign countries. And it doesn't even necessarily require a couple of generations. I really think that if I wasn't so self-conscious about where I came from and about trying to maintain some sort of connection, that I would have already lost a big chunk of any credibility I had with folks back home, because the problems that people encounter in most of my life right now are just fundamentally different from the problems that folks encountered or still encounter back home. And I really don't know, you know, obviously there's always been a class divide in the country. There's always been the elites versus the non-elites. But I really don't think that the divide has been quite as wide as it's been in the past 20 or 30 years.
Listening to you, I think, looking at the two candidates who are running for in the presidential election right now, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, you know, to a certain extent, I wonder whether either of them gets it and why either of them would be appealing to any of the people you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, you know, as someone who's not a huge fan of either, I suppose I agree with what you said. I think that what is mostly driving the voter preferences, which if you look at the white working class voting preferences, looks like they're going to go pretty disproportionately for Donald Trump in this election. I think it's mostly, and you know, that sort of resentment that we talked about towards the elites that's driving more of a negative feeling towards Hillary Clinton and frankly towards a lot of the other Republicans who preceded Donald Trump, which is why they didn't win. People recognize that Donald Trump maybe is a little full of it. They recognize that he doesn't share a lot of their values or share a lot of their experiences, but he's almost this proverbial middle finger. He's saying things to the elites that a lot of voters wish they themselves could say. And so I think he's able to channel a lot of frustrations, even though people don't feel that positively towards him.
He speaks to that pride we began by talking about.
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. A lot of these people just want to be seen. They felt so invisible, so looked down upon by the political process for a long time, that Trump, even though he's imperfect in a whole lot of ways, is able to capture the passion of a lot of folks because he sees these people. He tries to speak to them. He recognizes that pride and honor that they have. And he exploits it in some ways, even though a lot of people don't think that he's the solution so much as they think that he's a person who recognizes that they're struggling and tries to go after them, which at the end of the day, they've felt so ignored for so long that the bar is pretty low, and Trump clears that bar.
JD, thank you so much for talking.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
J.D. Vance is the author of Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis.